This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. This is a show about ideas, people, and behaviors that are considered inappropriate, out of bounds, or beyond the pale. The things you're not supposed to talk about if you're a school teacher, a college professor, a businessman, a politician, a parent, a neighbor, or even a podcast host. These are the things you're not supposed to say or even think if you're a good liberal, a good conservative, or a good citizen. Each week, I'll interview a person who has something bad to say. They might be a journalist or a professor. They might be a porn star or a drug dealer. They might just be an ordinary person with an ordinary job who doesn't care about the rules of polite society. I'm not interested in breaking the rules just to be a troublemaker. I'm interested in people who break the rules of conventional thought and who expand the scope of what is possible to say in our society. I'm interested in people who make me think. Imagine if we had the transcript of the collective unconscious of an entire society. If you were a scholar interested in understanding that society, I think you would be very interested in studying that transcript. This is what I've been saying for years and years to my students in regular universities and at Renegade University. Pornography, which now is consumed by virtually everyone in American society, is that transcript of the collective unconscious, I believe. My guest this week was the first academic scholar to take seriously this genre, this art form, this very popular culture that is simultaneously everywhere and nowhere. This is my interview with Linda Williams. So I'm in the house in the Berkeley, sort of lower hills, I guess you would say, of Linda Williams, a pioneer in, I think, and many people think, in academia for reasons we will discuss, and a hero to many of us in academia who chose to take paths that at the time were considered to be dangerous and wrong. So I'm really, I'm sort of honored to be here, actually, and I'm really grateful that you would have me here and to be willing to speak on Unregistered. I told you just before we started rolling that a lot of academics are very skittish about coming on this show, but you said you had no problem with it, which I appreciate. So thank you for doing this.
I'm happy to. And as I said, I think I have nothing to lose.
Yeah, we'll see.
Are they going to fire me?
That's right. You have tenure, right? And you're an emeritus. So yeah. So let's do this. I thought the best way to do this for the audience, many of whom probably will not know about your work, let's do the sort of what the headline would be of the capsule summary of your career. I mean, you, like, most famously, right, you're most famous for essentially pioneering what is now called porn studies, a term you don't even like.
Right.
But the study of pornography as a serious object of academic study, mm-hmm. Right?
That's true.
You were essentially the first, I believe, academic to do that, correct?
Well, I'm the first person to take it seriously as a form that needed to be paid attention to.
Right.
I think that would be fair to say.
And you treated it in your work the way that an English professor would write about a novel.
Exactly.
Right.
Yes.
That's what you did that mm-hmm. no one else had done before. There were, of course, there was academic talk about pornography, but it was as to how bad it was and how dangerous it was and or whether it should be censored.
Well, there were some people like Stephen Marcus. Mm-hmm. He wrote a pretty serious book about, it wasn't about film pornography, but it was about pornography. Mm-hmm. But I always felt that he was holding his nose.
He's anti-porn, isn't he?
Well, he came off as anti-porn, but that was sort of the way one had to be because it wasn't art.
That's right.
For him, it wasn't art.
Right.
And that was the question. And as a literary scholar, he could do that.
Right.
As a film scholar, I found it to be a genre.
Mm-hmm.
And genres are of intrinsic interest to us, to those of us who care about genres.
But the thing is, Linda, what you chose a completely insignificant art form because no one watches porn.
Right.
I mean, this is the great sort of what I like to call bourgeois silence that you just threw open the doors on, right? It's like everybody does this thing and no one talks about it.
Right, right.
And not in any serious way.
It went without saying
yeah.
that it was... trash.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly enough, in fact, I've just been trying to work on this idea. I'm trying to write an essay about the supposed end of obscenity.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, that there was this belief in the right about the time someone like Stephen Marcus was writing, or into the early 60s, that obscenity was going to disappear because we were going to be able to say, because there were all these things that were deemed obscene that were no longer, there was a sea change happening, mm-hmm. but what with sexual revolution and cultural revolutions and all of a sudden Lady Chatterley's Lover was not obscene.
Mm-hmm.
And along with Lady Chatterley's Lover, it became possible to say that these other things that were obscene were maybe okay too. And so there was this legal idea that one could develop the hardcore. And once you identified the hardcore, then you found that bad thing that was at the center that you could spit out. And all these other things could come in. But as that was happening, the very definition of sexuality was changing. It was becoming an important force,
right.
Something that we needed to not repress as badly as we had because sexual revolution was taking place.
Yeah.
And so as we were trying to pare down the hardcore, and that's the language of Walter Kendrick, which is, I think,
in The Secret Museum?
Yeah, a really interesting book.
A great book. It's called The Secret Museum. It's a history of pornography.
And I would say it was a book that enabled my book.
Yeah.
I couldn't have written it without Kendrick. So this idea of a hardcore, but at the same time, the hardcore was kind of melting in front of our very eyes. Mm-hmm. And so if sex was important, then obviously pornography was important to study.
That's what I've always been saying. You know, I mean, psychologists for how long have been telling us that sex and sexuality is at the center of our unconscious mind and at the center of our consciousness as well?
That was what Freud said,
and
certainly.
That's right. Freud and however many other psychoanalysts of all kinds, right, have been saying this forever and ever. We all sort of know this in some way or another, right? And yet we never talk about it. And with pornography, and we have the statistics now. I don't know if you've heard. Have you heard John Ronson's podcast on Pornhub? It's absolutely fantastic.
No.
You need to listen to this.
Is it about Pornhub?
Yes, it's about Pornhub and its effects on the industry. You need to listen to this.
Well, if you give me a recording of what we're making, I won't take notes. Thank you.
I will tell you. I will tell you later. I will remind you, I promise you. But he, one of the great moments in it is the president of Pornhub says, well, it's funny how much Americans, you know, complain about Pornhub and they always try to censor us and they're always talking about censoring our actors when in fact we know how many Americans are watching Pornhub.
They've got the stats.
It's 165 million people per day in America, which accounts for every single adult American. So that means that essentially virtually every American is watching Pornhub every single day. And yet no one's talking about it, right? Mm-hmm. And certainly in academia. So when I entered graduate school in 1991, there was no such thing, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was unheard of. I mean, not just porn. I'm talking about sex. We didn't talk about sex, you know. And that was one of the reasons I left, was because I needed to talk about sex. Because I thought it was important. Not because I'm a pervert, you know, although that's part of it. But, you know, it's a remarkable thing, isn't it? I call it the great bourgeois silence. I don't know if I coined that, but, you know, this is basically what Freud talked about, just repression.
Yes.
That we just don't talk about it from the Victorian era. Mm-hmm. And so here you come, we're kind of jumping ahead of here, but in 1989, you publish Hardcore, which is your most famous work probably, and that's the pioneering work where you take seriously porn as a film genre, as an object of study. At that 89, I mean, that was really, what was it like? I mean, you enter that world, you do talk about it in your book a bit, but describe it. Like, what was it like to do this at that time when no one was not only talking about porn, but not talking about sex? In academia.
Well, people were talking about sex because absolutely Freud had had paved the way. And I was reading at that time, I had already written a book on surrealism. Mm-hmm. And why was I interested in surrealism? Mm-hmm. It was fascinated by sex. It was fascinated by the return of the repressed. And so I was kind of primed to do this, not thinking that, but I had been studying Lacan. Lacan had actually been a surrealist and was interested in the absurdity. Before he became a more serious psychoanalyst, he received Salvador Dali in his apartment. Maybe it was Dali who received him. Anyway, they met, and one of them had a piece of cigarette paper that was glued to his nose just as a kind of gesture of absurdity. So I took very seriously the notion that the surrealists were interested in libido, interested in the return of the repressed. And I seriously studied psychoanalysis because I was doing this at a time when psychoanalysis was sort of taking over the academy and seemed to be the, as Freud would say, the royal road to the unconscious, to the structural foundations of our very being. So I think I was primed by the time I turned to pornography. The real question is why I turned to pornography.
Absolutely.
I think it was some kind of naivete at that time. It's because I was becoming a film scholar. I would have loved to have been the film scholar who wrote the book on Hollywood musicals, but that had already been written. My insight was that it was possible to talk about Hollywood musicals and to talk about the numbers in Hollywood musicals, which are those moments when you move from dialogue and speech into song and dance.
Right.
And I always loved those moments. I know some those people who hate musicals hate those moments. But I really loved that transition from one register into another register.
Yeah.
And I realized that this was my route into being able to talk about pornography in some kind of structural or structured way, that there was something to be said about the relation between the narrative and the number. And what is the narrative might present some kind of problem that a couple is having, and then the number would solve that problem, and that there was a kind of work being done by the pornography that I was looking at that time, which was of the mid 80s. Well, actually, I was looking at the history from Deep Throat from 72. What was Deep Throat? It was about solving the problem of a woman unable to achieve orgasm. And so I realized that there was a dynamic between the problem presented in the narrative and then the solution that was offered by the great sex that would happen. And once I had that insight coming from musicals, I realized I could write about the sexual numbers in a way that would make sense, that would be able to explain what work was being done of solving the problem.
Attempting to solve the problem, or assuming to solve the problem, or ostensibly solving the problem.
Yes. Deep Throat is a silly joke,
right.
But nevertheless, that was the game that was being played.
But in porn, one of the common criticisms of it is that there is no narrative, or not enough narrative, that it's just slam bam, it's just right to the sex.
But it isn't.
Okay.
I mean, that's why looking at the history of pornography was actually useful. So I went to the Kinsey Institute and I looked at the previous pornography that everyone had kind of ignored, the stag films, which only kind of jokey men had written about. And they weren't holding their nose, they were kind of laughing at it in a guy way.
So let's do that. I would love for you, the audience would love to hear you sort of walk us through, if you don't mind, walking us through the history of pornography, because that's what you do a lot in your book, mostly your book, in Hardcore. That's what you do.
Yeah.
Kind of start from the beginning and go through
the 20th century. So yeah, talk about that. Stag films, it's sort of phenomenon that you discovered.
Well, I mean, so I took the genre seriously, and I realized that people had opinions about pornography, but they didn't have much history because no one had actually written any serious history. And I didn't write a history. I wrote...
Well, it's not a comprehensive... You're not attempting to be a comprehensive
history. But I did take,
history.
You know, from the moment of the invention of cinema, and I didn't really look before that, but what was the invention of cinema and what was the pleasure of movement and the discovery of movement, the explosion of movement. And so I just tried to reconcile what I thought cinema was with what pornography was, and to see that pornography was part of cinema. And that was an important thing to say, because there was this tendency to want to eject it as the hardcore. But this process that I mentioned earlier, in which the hardcore kind of melts in front of your eyes and you realize that maybe there isn't a hardcore, at least that was the problem I was presenting in this book called Hardcore.
Right.
What is the hardcore? So definitely in an era of obscenity, stag films were the hardcore. They were obscene. They were illegal. Nobody was supposed to see them. If they did, it was an illegal act.
Describe them.
Black and white, 10 to 15 minutes max, silent films in which people who, if you see them today, they could be your great-great-great-grandparents.
God forbid.
There's a little bit of narrative. The plumber arrives. The pipes are clogged, and the plumber gets turned on. The woman who is concerned about her pipes gets them cleaned. One or two sexual acts take place in which you see close-ups of erect penises, penetration. You see spread legs. You see all of the things that precisely you were not allowed to see, and that no one was allowed to see legally in those days. It was obscene.
But they don't finish. Is that right? They don't show the end?
They don't, well...
They don't show the climax, the orgasm.
Yes. Well,
is that right?
What is the end? I mean, what is the end of a sexual act?
Good question.
Yeah. We are...
But they did not, right? They did not show the ejaculation?
Sometimes they did, sometimes they didn't.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. I may have simplified that a little too much in the book. I mean, there are definitely visible orgasms.
Okay. I've never seen a stag film. Yeah.
Never?
I don't think so. I'm a little too young. Well, I mean, when did they die out? I mean,
they died out with Deep Throat. I mean, they were still going strong in the late 60s.
Yeah,
well, even but where they added a little color, but they were not sound. It was just this idea that all you need to show is the kind of sex that you haven't seen before, and you don't need to do anything more because that's what has been missing. That's what has been obscene. And so you show the obscenity.
Right.
And so stag films are, I mean, first of all, they were shown in stag parties in the United States. In Europe, it was different. This is something I've learned more recently, and I didn't do a good job with Europe, but I didn't even try to do a job with Europe in the book. It was brothels for the most part. France, Italy, places like that. Brothels were quasi-legal. They were permitted, frowned upon, but permitted. And it was kind of normal for, let's say, an uncle to take a nephew to a brothel to initiate him into sex. And they would show the movies to kind of arouse people, whereas the stag parties, they might invite women. So if you were invited to a stag party, you were by definition, the audience for a stag film, but normal women were not part of that audience. And so these were films that were made only for men.
Men, right. And for these, and they were illicit and underground and illegal.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And yeah, I mean, I think my father told me about going to stag parties and watching these films. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I sort of remember that.
It was a kind of rite of passage for most men.
That's right. Yeah, it's something they would never forget, I think.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And so what do you make of that history? And what do you make of that art form?
Well, for me, the interesting thing was that it changed. Why did it change? Why did this film called Deep Throat, and which was not the only one, but it was the one that everyone talked about because it was so outrageous. Mm-hmm. Why did this film called Deep Throat suddenly become feature length with sound, and why did it concentrate on what I came to call the money shot, which is the visible ejaculation on the part of the penis, which would therefore define the end of the sex. Like when you earlier said, well, the stag films didn't end. Because we're so used to the climax being the visible evidence of the satisfaction of the sex act. Well, is that necessarily the climax for the woman? No. Mm-hmm. But there wasn't any concern in the stag film about the woman's pleasure.
Okay. Yep.
And yet, and to me the really extraordinary thing, much as one does not admire Deep Throat, is the fact that it was deeply concerned about the woman's pleasure.
That was the problem it was solving.
Yes, exactly.
That's right. We have a number of new courses and new instructors being added to Renegade University every week. Right now, you can take courses on postmodernism, the philosophy of Nietzsche, the politics of sex work, and my courses on the history of race in America, and a renegade history of the United States. Soon, we will be adding Daniele Bolelli's History of Martial Arts and Tom Nichols, An Instructional Design for Dying. We also have courses on American foreign policy and American history. To become a member of Renegade University and have access to any of these courses, as well as to The Quad, our own social media platform, and Office Hours, a chance to talk to any of our instructors via teleconferencing, go to renegadeuniversity.com and join. And on April 24th, 25th, and 26th, we'll all be convening at a Renegade University weekend, this time in Oakland and San Francisco, California, with a special guest, Daniel Coffeen, a star of Unregistered and one of RU's most popular faculty members. For more information and to buy tickets to the Renegade University weekend in Oakland and San Francisco with me and Daniel Coffeen, go to renegadeuniversity.com/live. Some people don't know about Deep Throat, by the way. You know, my audience is probably too young, so you want to talk about the plot of Deep Throat?
Yes.
And by the way, do you know the great documentary about it? What's it called?
I'm in it.
Are you?
Yes.
Oh, that's right.
I'm one of the talking
heads. My friends made that movie. So actually, yeah, that's one of the
Fenton and Randy.
Yeah, World of Wonder.
Yes.
I love those guys.
In fact, they filmed me in this very house.
Oh, good. Yeah, that's okay. I must have seen you then. Yeah, that's right. One of my other exposures to you. Yeah, they're great. You know, these are the people who discovered RuPaul and are the producers of RuPaul's Drag Race. Uh-huh, Fenton Bailey, Randy Barbato of World of Wonder Productions. They were the first people to option my book, as a matter of fact.
Is that right?
They were going to make a Renegade History of the United States TV show.
And they never did.
It just didn't happen, not because of them, but yeah, because of Hollywood. But I've done other projects with them. I've been on a lot of their shows too, as a talking.
Yeah,
those are great guys, and I think it's a great film. Did you like it? I mean,
I'm happy with it. Yeah. I don't like what I wore.
I think you wore it was great. Whatever you wore. The cultural significance of that movie was immense, you know, and it was playing in, I think, just almost every medium to large city in the country.
It was, yes. Yeah. In fact, in a subsequent book called Screening Sex, I write about what it was like to go see it in the it was probably, it wasn't 72, as because I was in the provinces. I was in Denver, but we got up a little party and went to see it, and it was like an experience. And I compare that to the experience of seeing Last Tango, which was also an experience that moved people.
You would call it a nearly pornographic film, I would say. Last Tango in Paris.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So tell me about the experience of seeing Deep Throat in 1972.
Let me first tell you about Deep Throat.
Yes, please.
Because the experience of pornography prior to Deep Throat was, there are other important films that changed, but Deep Throat was the one that everybody saw, and it was kind of obligatory to see. You felt if you were...
Oh, really?
If you were...
Hip.
A sophisticated, hip person in the early 70s of someone who was in some way experiencing sexual revolution. I was, in fact, married and all of that, but I felt part of the sexual revolution because I had birth control pills early and felt like I was liberated from the usual kind of fear of pregnancy. When one went to see this film in order to see hardcore explicit sex, and what was the experience that it gave you? It gave you a variety of sexual positions. It gave you a lot of fellatio because that was narratively justified, motivated, you might say, by the fact that the doctor in the film diagnosed the patient, Linda Lovelace, as someone who had her clitoris in her throat. Therefore, the miracle was that it was possible to see more of sex with fellatio. Because there you get an expressive face that can smile, that can swallow, that can do all of these things, and you get an expressive penis, which will do its thing. It's more than penetration. In fact, fellatio became all the rage. It was if it was a new new sex, as if it hadn't existed. From time immemorial.
I believe that oral sex was in the DSM until the 1960s as a pathology.
Exactly.
It was, yeah, right.
That's no,
right.
And there are
along with homosexuality.
Right, yeah. And there are these trials, a lot of trials, of obscenity trials of Deep Throat in city after city, especially in New York, where it had a particularly important impact, where the judge in the trial... It's really obvious that he learned about fellatio for the first time from the sexologists who were asked to testify. And so this is the tradition of speaking sex that I like to talk about, that sex became speakable, that everyone was talking about this new thing as if they had invented it, as if it didn't exist before. But in fact, you know, like when Bill Clinton said, "I did not have sex with that woman," I think there was a kernel of truth to it because fellatio was alternative. It was something else. Yeah. And just as there are young women today who feel they are virgins if they have anal sex.
I've heard this too from men. They say, "Oh, well, if it's a blowjob, it's not cheating on my wife."
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, so that's Deep Throat. That's the basic the storyline there. So what was it like for you?
For me to go see it. Yeah. Oh, okay. A bunch of us, graduate students at the University of Colorado.
In your 20s.
One of them was a philosophy professor, and his wife, who was, I think, a graduate student, and... my husband, and there were about six of us, I think. We just decided to make a long drive. It was like a 50-minute drive to go to Denver from Boulder. So it was an outing. And we went to, I think it was called the Pussycat Theater. So it wasn't your normal theater. It was a theater
that was... theater.
Porn theater, yeah. But porn theaters were not necessarily sleazy at this point. Mm-hmm. They were, you know, like Times Square sleazy, mm-hmm. the kind of thing that Andy Warhol would write about. Mm-hmm. This was more like upscale.
Oh, yeah.
Meaning that you had to pay a little bit more for the tickets. It wasn't like there wasn't ejaculate all over the floor.
And there were no men in trench coats, I take it.
Right, exactly. And we were proof because we were young student types.
Relatively wholesome, right?
Yeah, I certainly thought I was a wholesome person, but I was really up for the adventure of seeing what this film had to hold.
So I just have to say, I cannot imagine, you know, having spent 25 plus years in the Academy as a undergraduate, graduate student, and professor, I can't imagine going to watch porn with any fellow, with any colleagues, and especially not people who are already, you know, tenured or have, you know, who are already professors. I mean, I find it to be, as we were talking about before we started recording, mm-hmm. possibly the most conservative and uptight and puritanical institution or culture in this country, academia. I find people to be profoundly repressed in ways that you don't find in the rest of the culture. Does that at all comport with your experience? Maybe not, because you've been sort of...
No, because...
You've been in the weirdo departments, though. I'm talking about, like, in history, I can tell you it's pretty buttoned down.
Well, the professor we went with, I think he was the one who had the car.
Okay.
It
was also in the 70s.
He was a philosopher.
Yeah, I know. This is also in the 70s.
He did lose tenure.
Oh, see? I told you. They ran them all out. All the cool ones, they got run out.
On the other hand, I got tenure.
Yeah. Well, you got tenure before you started writing about porn.
I did. You're right.
This is very important. I've heard you talk about this.
Yes.
And it's you actually advise your students not to write about porn until
although,
they get tenure.
And I think I still do.
Yeah, you should.
I think I still do. Because it can go so many different ways.
Indeed. So did you, at that point, did you develop an interest in pornography in any way, either intellectually or just as a consumer?
Well, I was at that time, I was really interested in the phenomenon of sitting in a theater with other people, where the goal of the film is to arouse you, and that's a phenomenon.
Yeah, another thing I've never done. I've never watched porn with in a group.
Yeah. I was just fascinated by that. Uh-huh. And I think that is the reason why, if you watch Deep Throat, it's got this one bad joke after another. Because the jokes were there to set you at ease. If you're not going to explode in an orgasm in the theater, mm-hmm. And you're probably not... because you're with other people. I mean, that was the phenomenon of Deep Throat, that it wasn't the sleazy raincoat brigade, that it was, here we are, we're together in this theater and we're celebrating sex in some way. And the laughter was an easy way to make that celebration kind of more comfortable.
Oh, so it really was, perceived by you and probably by other people in the audience as... most importantly, am I right, sort of a part of the sexual revolution, the counterculture.
Precisely.
And the liberatory potential.
In fact, in that film by your friends, Randy and Fenton John Waters says, "Well, you might be sitting next to Angela Lansbury."
That's right. Yeah. That's great. Yeah. So
it was a social experience that going to see Deep Throat, and everybody did just for the experience. There was a kind of, how am I going to undergo this experience? A kind of experiment on some level.
Okay. Now this is what I want to ask you. So this is in 1972, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And you're in grad school and your interests, have they already turned toward cinema?
Yes, they have.
At that point.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. because you don't work on porn.
But it's not 72, because the film opened in New York, and it was probably 73.
Okay.
We're in the provinces, maybe 74.
Okay. Right. But you don't write about pornography until 1989.
Oh, no, I don't. Right. I don't dare do something like that.
So you spend more than a decade not even touching porn. You're writing very academic studies of first French surrealist film, right? And then film generally.
Yes, but look at the films.
Figures of Desire is the title of your dissertation, which has become your first book, which we're looking at right now. So that was your first work, and that was your focus, and your I'd say orientation toward sex, sexuality, and pornography was quite different than, wasn't it? Than in your later work, you've said this.
And... Yes, but I would say it was of a piece. It was something led me to down this primrose path towards pornography.
Primrose path toward pornography. That's the subtitle of your memoir, I think. Sure, I see through lines immediately between mm-hmm. Figures of Desire, which is your study of surrealism, with your later work on pornography. But there's a contradiction too, because you've said, and well, it's there in Figures of Desire, you are applying a Freudian theory to film and mm-hmm. to sexuality in film that is at the time was sort of de rigueur among feminist scholars, right? Which is sort of the castration theory, the fear of castration.
Absolutely.
The sexualized woman represents.
Yeah, it's all there. And okay. And it all worked perfectly.
Yeah. Right? Oh, yeah.
Too perfectly.
Totally.
I'm sure.
Yeah. And the same stuff you wrote about horror movies, very similar, right? The castration anxiety, mm-hmm. the essay you have, mm-hmm. right? So can you just tell people, you know, the theory, lay out the theory and the how you applied it at that time, which you no longer entirely subscribe to.
It was a Lacanian. I had been to France. I had undergone a conversion to Lacan, mm-hmm. who seemed to have the proper structuralist and also psychoanalytic understanding of the human subject. Mm. And the idea is that the subject is not, you know, this coherent thing we think we are, reasonable, mm-hmm. Governed by rules, but in fact we are these dispersed desires and perverted because perversion is not like a sickness. Perversion is the natural state of desire in our culture, one is obliged to literally, what does perverse mean? It means to slide away from the direct thing to a more indirect thing. Oh. And so fetishism is a perversion, and right. fetishism is so rampant in surrealist cinema. Right. And what is fetishism according to Freud and Lacan? It is the way of not confronting the fact that there is castration. Sliding off, that one becomes fascinated by the, let's say, the frilly underwear, because the frilly underwear are the things that disguise the fact that if you looked at male and female bodies, you would see that the female is, quote, castrated.
Lacking the penis, which is...
Lack.
Which represents castration,
yeah.
A violent
act. And so we are all based on the idea of this theory, was that we are all based on lack. Mm-hmm. And men and women are
feel the same way. For men, it would be the fear of losing it.
The fear of losing what they have.
And women are driven by their lack of a
penis. I remember posing this question to Christian Metz, who was my professor in Paris, where I was learning all of this stuff, and saying, you think it's really the same for men and women? And he said, je suis persuadé that men and women are exactly the same.
Really?
In this formation of their subject based on lack. Huh. And the desire to fill the lack.
Yeah.
And I bought it.
Yeah, I know.
And the feminist in me was a little... in fact, I think when I finally published a new edition of this book, at the end I said a little bit about an afterword in which, you know, I probably didn't do the proper feminist thing that I should have done by these films. Because, you know, why are they slitting women's eyeballs, a woman's eyeball at the beginning of Un Chien Andalou, which was the first really spectacular and powerful surrealist cinema, surrealist film? If you remember, there's a moment where Louis Buñuel, who is sharpening a razor, looks up at the sky and he sees a razor-thin cloud going across the moon. And he's sharpening this razor as he does this. And then suddenly there's a woman who appears and he pulls the razor across her eyeball. Mm. And that was so shocking to me when I saw that in a classroom at Berkeley
still
when
shocking.
I was young.
Yeah.
It is still shocking.
Sure.
It's shocking because it's not just that a man pulls a razor across a woman's eye. That's shocking, but that's violence. Mm-hmm. But it's motivated by this kind of aesthetically beautiful movement of the cloud across the moon, mm-hmm. which is analogous to the razor being pulled across the eye.
Okay.
And these are the figures, you know, this comparison of, and this is a classic surrealist figure, mm-hmm. In a sense of metaphorical figure, as you take something like an umbrella and you compare it to a sewing machine, you take really, really disparate things and you compare them. Mm-hmm. And that's the nature of the surrealist figure.
Mm-hmm.
So I was excited by my ability to understand these figures of desire as being examples of the desire to enact castration, but then to solve the castration with the fetish.
Right.
That will never solve it.
Okay.
But
yeah.
But this is what the figures of desire do. They're endless figures of disrupting the unity of the subject and then trying to, there's a moment at the end of Louis Buñuel's last film where a woman is sewing a bloody piece of cloth or embroidering, and it's all about opening and closing, lack mm-hmm. and absence. And so, you know, I really enjoyed it. I thought I had solved the mystery of these films.
Okay, but I mean, it comports very much with a lot of feminist analysis at the time, though, right? Which is
absolutely,
yeah, because you're saying, yeah, okay, I wasn't sure about that. The woman, the object of desire, is desired in a fetishistic way because she represents the castrated male. The male fears being castrated, so he looks at the woman, the object of desire, with disdain, disgust, fear, right? Am I getting it right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that was...
But also desire.
And desire at the same time. So it's an endless loop.
Right.
Endless sort of unhealthy, one might say, misogynistic, it ends up being, right? Loop.
Yes.
Am I right? Okay. And that's the way that many feminists, not all, but many feminists, and I guess you, looked at porn originally.
Yeah. Oh, that's a good point. Yeah.
Oh, good. I thought. So that's to me the transition you make mm-hmm. between your early work on surrealism and your later work on pornography. Because you change that. I mean, but you sort of change your mind about that.
I do.
So you do eventually change your mind, and I want to get to that in a second. Once you get to writing about porn more than a decade later, right? Or about mm-hmm. a decade later. But there's another thing in surrealist film that you were very interested in, or maybe you were less interested in this, but you would acknowledge that it's very much a part of it, which you call its subversion of rational bourgeois civilization, right? That's what you say in the book it was known for, and that's sort of celebrated for, and still is, and I think that's, we agree, right? That's still, mm-hmm. it's very much a part of surrealism,
mm-hmm.
Is sort of pointing to the absurdity of rational bourgeois civilization, subverting it in very various ways, showing how it's actually damaging to people's bodies, to people's psyches, in all sorts of ways, the rationalism of bourgeois civilization, which, you know, my work is all about that. My work mm-hmm. is all about challenges to rational bourgeois mm-hmm. civilization. Now, were you, you start with that in your analysis of surrealism, and then say, but I'm interested more in what goes on between men and women and this castration thing that happens. But what was your take on rational bourgeois civilization at that time? Were you pro or con?
I was definitely con.
You were con, okay.
But you know, I look back, you know, I'm older and wiser now. I was a revolutionary. I believed I was a revolutionary. Mm-hmm. I hadn't thought deeply about what revolution really meant. But I thought that the surrealists were on the side of disturbing all of the repressive factors in bourgeois civilization, and they were. Mm-hmm. But you know, I now think of it as very much a kind of masculine pose. Mm. I thought that, you know, Buñuel and Dalí were both deeply, deeply misogynistic. Mm. And I was at that time in my thinking more on the side of the revolution than on the side of the women.
Mm.
And it was always the woman's eyeball that would be sliced.
Yeah, right.
and I was kind of blind to that myself.
Okay.
At the time.
Now, this is so in the early 70s there were many revolutions going on, right? And my mm-hmm. parents were involved in just what we would call a political revolution, sort of, you know, in terms of seizing control of the means of production and institutions.
Yes.
And
yes.
Economics and public policy, mm-hmm. right? You were interested, sounds like, maybe in that too, but in different revolutions, sort of what I would call the revolution of the counterculture of the 60s, right?
Yes, and very much opposed to the war in Vietnam.
Sure.
And my husband was a draft resister.
Good man for that, by the way. One of the great... Anybody who resisted any draft is my hero,
right.
Period. But it seems like you were more interested in the cultural revolution that was going on.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay, and what did you...
I thought they were the same thing. I was very naive.
Yeah, I think they're very different. And I think that actually many people who are on one side, who are revolutionaries in one way, that tend to be actually, well, you know this very well, tend to be quite reactionary mm-hmm. When it comes to things like sexuality.
Yes.
And culture,
yes,
right?
Yes.
I mean, that's been my experience. Another reference to a documentary. Have you seen the documentary Berkeley in the 60s?
Oh, of course.
Right.
Yeah.
My mother's in it briefly.
I believe I'm in it too, but yeah. You know, not sure.
But I thought it was a great, I talk about this a lot. I think they do this great thing, having grown up here during that time, well, I was a kid, but later, of showing the difference between what was going on sort of in the counterculture in San Francisco, where it was, you know, the beat poets and the hippies and, you know, smoking weed and rolling in the grass in Golden Gate Park and dodging the draft, but mm-hmm. dodging the draft in order to basically enjoy yourself.
Right.
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 Versus over here in Berkeley, mm-hmm, which mm-hmm. were the serious people, were doing serious political work, you know, opposing the war,
right,
fighting for civil rights,
getting arrested,
seeking socialism, you know,
yes.
arguing about Marxism, doing that, you know, which those are my parents, right? Even mm-hmm, though they were interested mm-hmm. in this other stuff, but they really, and they were sort of opposed. It wasn't just that they were happened to be on other sides of the bay, but they were actually hostile to each other. At least I think the serious politicos over mm-hmm. here were definitely hostile to what they saw of sort of the frivolous Allen Ginsbergs of the world, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The frivolous.
Yeah, we definitely experienced that too.
Okay.
My husband was a Berkeley radical political, but then there was the... what was it? Oh, I know. I went away and hitchhiked across Europe for 1967. This was my sentimental education. Mm. I just went off to Europe in order to experience the world. Mm. And when I came back, it was 1968. Mm. And my husband had become, he wasn't my husband then, he was my boyfriend. He became my boyfriend. He was a hippie.
Mm-hmm.
He had become a hippie from a
okay.
Berkeley political,
oh.
you know, radical,
okay.
who had refused induction into the war. He transferred to San Francisco State and became a hippie.
Oh,
and
wow.
this was like and I had kind of missed that transition
uh-huh.
because I was I was an au pair in Paris. I was trying to learn French. I was
trying to be serious.
And then I came back here, and the world had changed. Mm. And there was this song. I was hitchhiking across the United States to come home. If you're going to San Francisco, you have to wear a flower in your hair.
Yeah.
I mean, what was that all about? I had missed it. But then I encountered it, and it was an explosion of touchy-feely, you know, hippy-dippy kinds of things that were less serious, but were definitely happening.
They were about the body.
All about the body, yes.
And over here, we were about the mind.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. I mean, that's, to me, a big difference between the two camps.
Exactly.
So you started, I take it you were attracted not only to him, but to his new culture.
I was.
Okay.
I was.
And by the late 60s.
And marijuana and all of those things.
Okay. Oh.
Which I had not been into before.
And so did you become a bit of a hippie yourself? Were your allegiances there?
I'll tell you the answer to that. I participated in a sit-in. A good old-fashioned, nonviolent sit-in at the Oakland Induction Center. I think it was 68.
Excellent.
And we were beaten severely, savagely by police. And this became the Oakland Seven, I think was the name of the.
That's right.
Then I became a witness in that trial.
Oh, really?
And I was described as a mini-skirted co-ed.
Really?
Because I was back at Berkeley. But I wore a short skirt. And in fact, somebody was just talking about this the other day. All women were defined this way if they wore a mini-skirt. I was a mini-skirted co-ed.
Yeah, of course.
Which is very, very doubly gendered in a way.
Sure.
Yeah. But I was able to describe being beaten by police, and that was effective.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's also gendering you. I mean, you become then the victim.
Yeah.
The classic female victim, too.
And so then gradually, you know, the double standards began to become apparent, but they weren't immediately apparent. I was kind of slow to discover feminism. I mean, I don't think I was really slow, but feminist psychoanalytic was my way of discovering feminism. Mm. And it was many years before I abandoned the psychoanalysis as an intellectual tool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm just thinking about, you know, the continuity again between your earlier life and earlier career with, again, your obsession, fascination with pornography. And I got to think that your move, at least tentatively, toward the counterculture and at that moment had to be, you know, something in you, you know, that makes sense. That fits with someone who would be willing to break the taboo of studying porn seriously 20 years later, right? Does that make sense?
I suppose. Okay. It never seemed audacious. It never seemed
really
deeply radical. It seemed like a natural thing to do for me.
To study porn.
And actually, I don't think I ever suffered any deep consequences either.
You've talked about that. So Hardcore comes out in 89, and as I said, it was pretty much alone at that time. It was the first of its kind. I mean, yes, Marcus is his first name? Paul? Stephen Marcus had written the book, but it wasn't really, I wouldn't call that a serious study the way that yours was. But you did not experience any backlash.
Well, sure. The so-called, because at this point we are polarized. There are the feminists who are anti-pornography and who have determined that the real problem.
Oh, yeah. Situate this. Yeah, let's do that. Let's do the porn wars. A lot of people don't know the history here.
Okay.
The late 70s, early 80s, that stuff. Because that's where you're kind of just after that, right? You're not writing in the midst of that.
No, I'm not. It's after that.
Post-porn wars. Okay.
So so people like Andre Dworkin, especially Andre Dworkin, began to express their feminism, and I think partly because it was hard to just sort of find what was the thing that needed to be attacked. Instead of attacking inequality directly, which they did, but it was so easy to find the scapegoat in in pornography. And so in the early stages of feminist development, people like Robin
Morgan
would say pornography is the theory, rape is the practice, which if you think about it is just an insidious kind of way to put it. If rape is the practice, the theory is not pornography. The theory is misogyny. The theory is patriarchy. But pornography is just an easy target, a very easy target. So it was in the midst of those kinds of theories, which were happening on college campuses and which I was certainly aware of, that and I, which I believed were true. I actually thought, pornography's bad. I had gone to see, Deep Throat, but I didn't think it was bad. I didn't think it was especially good. I just thought it was interesting.
You weren't offended.
I wasn't offended. And there was this film called Not a Love Story, which you may have ever seen.
It's a documentary, right?
A documentary.
About pornography, which
about
is anti-porn.
Very anti-porn documentary.
It's like, no, duh, it's not a love story. That's the point.
Right.
Which you have said, yes.
And I saw it. I saw this film and I thought, oh, this, I guess this is true. But I didn't think about it very deeply. But I, you know, I was a good feminist and, you know, so I thought I should be anti-pornography.
Okay.
And when did I actually change?
Were you aware of the handful of sex-positive feminists at that time who were challenging this stuff?
Well, I wasn't exactly in the thick of it because...
people like Ellen Willis is a hero of mine.
I wasn't a lesbian. The fact that I wasn't a lesbian made it harder for me to, I would say... immediately take sides because it was quite clear that a split was happening between, at that time, lesbian. You wouldn't have called them queer activists, and I did have friends who were who were lesbian activists, and I remember. I'm sorry, I cannot remember the sequence of events, but there was this conference at Barnard that was
very famous in 1982. This was like the first academic conference on porn, basically. In 1982,
and it split.
Yep, that's when the fights sort of congealed. I guess.
And I wasn't part of that. Not being a sexual minority myself at that time. I think I was on the sidelines.
Okay.
But I certainly had...
But lesbians tended to be, during that fight, anti-porn. Is that what you're saying?
I'm not sure. Okay. I think the split actually took place because lesbians wanted to express an alternative sexuality.
Right.
And there was a period, and here I'm probably conflating my memory of what happened with my... notion of what the pornography was doing, because lesbians did start to make pornography.
Make their own pornography, right.
And it tended to be kind of boring pornography and erotic in nature,
right.
You would have pretty female bodies and lots of trees and like that.
Blue skies.
But I should have a better chronology. Eventually, though, when I decided to write about pornography, and I wrote about, I think I decided to write about pornography with some of the same I'll show you enthusiasm that I had when I said I'm going to write on film to my advisors when I was in Colorado. In this case, I thought, well, wouldn't this be interesting if what did I? I can't actually remember what first intrigued me about it.
You said, you do say, you admit in the 1999 edition of Hardcore that you had a, quote, prurient interest in it.
Yeah, I would never have said that earlier.
I know. Because you admit that, yeah.
No, you know, definitely I knew that pornography and that, I also later on write about Last Tango in Paris, that was a real turn on for me. And now it's politically incorrect to be turned on by, once again,
okay.
because Maria Schneider was apparently abused in that.
By Marlon Brando.
Right? Well, and also by the director, Bernardo Bertolucci.
Okay, right.
Not in the sense of sexually abused, but psychically abused. Mm-hmm. They sprung things on her that she wasn't prepared for.
Right.
And
there's a famous sex scene in it that pushed the envelope in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you're like, we're in the 80s, so it's post...
Oh, okay.
So we're post porn wars. Feminists sort of split over this, right?
Right,
so the more dominant anti-porn feminists like Andrea Dworkin and Catherine MacKinnon become famous, and they pass some ordinances that censor porn, which become overturned by the Supreme Court. But meanwhile, they are coming up against this new generation of then called sex-positive feminists, people like Ellen Willis,
right.
A hero of mine. And,
yeah, mine too.
Yeah, many others. You know, in the younger generation, Laura Kipnis, who was later, but and others, and you. Who's had very different takes on porn and sexuality and women's sexuality. And
I become a self-proclaimed feminist and a psychoanalytic feminist, but I begin writing about, and this is partly because I'm no longer able to do any of the avant-garde things that I wanted to do because I am in an English department.
Oh, okay.
And in an English department, I have to do English things. So I start doing American film.
Meaning you couldn't study your French surrealism anymore.
I couldn't.
Right.
I couldn't ever.
Because you're now
even,
in an English department.
I could never even teach it.
Yeah. And that was your first love.
My first love. But I'm actually really grateful that I got away from that kind of avant-garde sensibility, which thought that to be avant-garde was to be anti-bourgeois and was to solve all of the political problems were automatically solved if you were avant-garde. Mm. And I've come to really be suspicious of that attitude.
Mm-hmm.
And partly I think it was an accident that I was in an English department. I had to teach American film. And I began looking at a feminist perspective on American cinema.
Right.
And that was when I discovered so-called women's films.
Right.
And women's films were these films in which women suffered, maternal melodramas, romances, but women would always suffer.
Mm.
They weren't the comedies at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote an article that to me was very important on Stella Dallas, which was a 1937 melodrama about a suffering mother who sacrifices everything for her child and who ironically says at one point in her career, a woman wants to be something else besides a mother. At this point, I was pregnant. I was teaching this film, and I definitely wanted to be something else besides a mother. But the trajectory of that woman's narrative is that she, Stella Dallas, is that ultimately she only wants to be a mother, and the only way she can be a good mother is to pretend to disown her daughter. And so she ends up with nothing except noble sacrifice. Mm. And these sacrifices became a theme that I was fascinated by in the so-called women's films in which women are sacrificing. And so this was my way to discover feminism and to explore feminism in the context of the melodramas of American cinema, which is still something that I'm struggling with today, but I've discovered that melodrama is something much broader than I thought.
Yeah.
That it is, in fact, the kind of the glue of popular culture.
Yeah, you've made me melodrama in some ways might be the one of the overarching themes in all of your work, or much of your work.
Mm-hmm. I now see that.
Yeah, and you made me rethink melodrama when I was reading your stuff again about race, which we'll talk about in a second. Your more recent stuff on race. But your reading of those women's films, so these are films that were popular among women and targeted at women audiences.
I think I was trying to understand why my mother would go cry at a movie in which a woman would sacrifice and suffer.
Ah, okay. And what era? We're talking sort of early, mid 20th century?
I was pregnant.
No. The films. The films are popular.
These 30s films.
Oh, it's a 30s genre. Because I think of the... Is this post-code?
And 40s.
Oh, so it's post-code, motion picture code.
Absolutely
post-code.
Oh,
I see. Because before the code, you have the fallen woman genre, which is the opposite.
Yeah, a whole different thing.
That's the cool stuff. Those are the badass women.
These are the noble sacrificing women.
Okay, so the motion picture production code comes into effect in 1934.
Yes, and I guess, really
and
effective.
And I didn't know this about... and so they cleaned up everything. There were no more gangster films celebrating gangsters. There were no more fallen women films celebrating the woman who kills her husband and takes his money and has sex with many men and women and travels the world and is a, you know, now we would call them a badass, right?
Right.
Gets replaced by, you know, clean cut, wholesome Americans doing clean cut, wholesome
housewives
things.
Housewives.
So, but suffering. I didn't know about this sort of this women's film genre. It's a whole genre, I guess, during that period.
Absolutely. No, it's very, very popular.
Oh, I guess since I wasn't.
Marianne Doan has a wonderful book on it.
Oh, okay. And so your mother was a fan of these.
Yes. And my mother and I used to stay up and watch the movies. Late night television.
And she would cry and you wouldn't.
No. We would cry together.
Okay,
we would cry together.
Okay.
I wanted to understand that. But I wanted to differentiate myself as a feminist from my mother's generation.
Okay. And then, so how do you explain why she cried and why she cared so much about these films?
Because the suffering of a victim is crucial to the narrative. It is the way sympathy is generated. To this day, if you suffer, you earn my sympathy, even though you haven't done anything but suffer. I mean, it's not like you're heroic. I mean, you just suffer.
That's right.
But there's this moral credit that is given to suffering, which is, I think, that's why Trump can today proclaim that he is the victim of a Democratic hoax.
Okay.
Because he's claiming there's this vying to be the victim.
Sure.
That takes place in our culture.
Sure.
Which is hugely important, and which is what gives a kind of, and which is why melodrama is a moral genre, and in fact, it's no longer even a genre. It is so pervasive in our culture, but I'm getting ahead of myself. This is what I'm working on now.
Define melodrama, though, because it is in it's in much of your work.
Yes. It is a story in which someone suffers wrongly, and one can say that it is wrong and it needs to be rectified, and that the person who either the person who suffers or the person who tries to rectify the suffering has earned the ability to seek vengeance. It's Rambo. Rambo suffers, and then he's able to refight the entire Vietnam War. He's entitled to, because he has suffered so much. And it is this hypocritical, deeply American, but not only American, belief that to suffer is to earn moral validity.
Yeah, and virtue. One becomes virtuous by their suffering.
Exactly.
By being a victim.
Right.
Well, it's interesting that you cite Donald Trump, Rambo, and then the characters in these women's films of the 30s and 40s. But most people talk nowadays, you know, they talk about the culture of victimhood these days. And it's usually, we're talking about what goes on in college campuses, actually, right? That
yes.
A whole new cast has been given
triggers.
This. Yes. So
triggers.
And this brings us to your later work, which is not about pornography, or much of it isn't, you know, which is about race in film and mm-hmm. television. Mm-hmm. You've written about race in film and race in television, in particular The Wire. You have a whole book on that. Tell us about, I mean, talk about that. Like, what's, you see, at least as I read you, the way that the relations between blacks and whites in this country historically have been presented is through melodrama. And originally it was the white victims and the black rapists, right?
Originally, where do we start? It matters where you start.
Before Birth of a Nation? What is there before Birth of a Nation?
Uncle Tom.
Oh, okay, right, of
Uncle
course.
Uncle Tom is the original black victim.
I was thinking film. I was thinking film, but yes, okay, so right.
But Uncle sure. Tom, there are many film versions of Uncle Tom.
Absolutely.
But it was, at that point,
that's right.
Uncle Tom was past its prime as a novel.
That's right.
It had really done its major work.
Yeah, your use of the Tom figure
on stage
is so huge. The more I think about it, yeah, and that's what your book on race is. So you playing the race card is the book. Mm-hmm. It's sort of the what you show how the Tom figure has been used and refigured in all sorts of ways. So talk about the original Uncle Tom and who he was. I mean, sort of the pure victim, the innocent, virtuous victim, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
I mean, just some people okay. actually don't know the story.
Yes, so, I know. Yeah. No, and we're not supposed to because
really?
To talk about
oh, because it's politically
Uncle
incorrect.
Tom is so politically
right.
incorrect,
it's a,
which is
so
why
important.
It's important
it's
to
so important.
Recognize that. And
yeah.
of course, black people don't want to say that they in any way identify mm-hmm. with Uncle Tom because it's yeah. become such a...
Right.
And James Baldwin talks about crying at Uncle. It's a wonderful essay.
Oh, yeah?
And he talks about crying at Uncle Tom and that... The fact that he shouldn't cry at Uncle Tom, but
I should read that.
Yeah.
Wow.
I can't remember the name, but yeah. of the essay.
Feeling ashamed. Mm-hmm. What was he ashamed of? Do you remember what was Baldwin ashamed of? Ashamed of identifying with Tom?
Identifying with victimhood when you need to identify with the strength yeah. that can fight Whitey.
That's right. Right. So Tom in the original.
Well, Tom in the original is in the original being the novel.
Yes.
Now, you know, I don't believe that there was an Uncle Tom. I mean, there are many Uncle Tom figures. Harriet Beecher Stowe just happened to write this novel that was trying to oppose the Fugitive Slave Act, mm-hmm. and which saw fugitive slaves as honorable people trying to save themselves, trying to escape from suffering. Mm-hmm. Uncle Tom became a kind of amalgam figure for her, but he was the good slave mm-hmm. in the sense that he didn't run. Uncle Tom's mistake was not to run. Mm-hmm. Eliza, I mean, so she splits this narrative into the fugitive slave as a woman who does run because she's got a child, and she heroically crosses the Ohio River on ice floes mm-hmm. with the dogs and the slave catchers behind her. So you have Uncle Tom, pure victim, gets sold down river and suffers and suffers and suffers and is finally beaten to death. Whereas you have the other story, which is Eliza escaping the mulatta, mm-hmm. actually, who can actually pass for white. And so it's a story that goes deep into the South and towards the North, but ironically, nowhere for black people to achieve freedom.
Right.
Stowe didn't get there.
Because what happens to Eliza?
Well, and could Lincoln even imagine that? No. He was toying with the idea of going back to Africa.
Right.
So it's a total mess, but it captures the imagination of the entire country, especially the North, mm-hmm. especially the white people in the North who identify with the South that they never even knew, mm-hmm. but sing the songs. I grew up singing Swanee River mm-hmm. and Old Folks at Home. I mean, I think I was learning to play them on the guitar. And this is, you know, this Stephen Foster.
This is Blackface Minstrelsy we're talking about.
Exactly.
Yeah, which I've written a lot about. Yes,
yes.
Exactly. Became the most popular art form in America for a century.
Not only the most important, but the first popular art in American culture.
Beginning really in the 1820s. There's evidence that it starts in the 1820s, that early. Yeah.
Right. Okay, so that's the story of Uncle Tom.
Yeah.
It has many manifestations. It gets played all over the United States as theater. It becomes song.
But importantly, Tom is a sympathetic figure.
The sympathetic black man.
He's the first sympathetic black man for white people.
Right, because they'd been figures of fun or of, you know, if there were slave uprisings, they could be figures of danger.
Yep.
So this sympathy, and this is, you know, this is mid-19th century culture of sympathy, when melodrama is really, really at its height and recognized as such.
Melodrama is also Manichaean, right? There's villains
and
heroes. There's good and evil, and that's that, right? Okay.
And
for the first time, black people are on the good side. They're on the side of the angels.
As opposed to figures of fun.
Right. Derision or fear.
Yeah.
Right.
And so this is a sea change in American sympathy. It is the sea change that leads to the possibility of the Civil War.
Yep.
When Lincoln met Harriet Beecher Stowe.
It's the template, I think, for our racial politics today.
Yeah, I think so too.
Well, that's the argument in your book, as a matter of fact. But
I'm glad you agree.
That was my theory. I had come to it in a different way than you did before I'd read your book. But when I read it, I thought, oh God, she nails this. Yes. But then Tom gets refigured and sort of flipped in some ways.
Yes.
And reversed in various ways through the 19th and 20th century all the way, because your book goes all the way up until like the 1990s or even later. Right?
You look at Roots.
Roots. Roots to 70, the 70s, right?
I try to look at only those moments where there are changes in sympathy.
Right.
Big changes in terms of media. So I look at the novel, I look at theater, and that was the Tom era.
Right.
And then film, and that with film, the arrival of film, you begin this transition towards another great big popular American melodrama of black and white, which is Birth of a Nation, which does reverse, I mean, literally reverse. In fact, Thomas Dixon, who wrote the novels upon which this film was based, originally was writing a parodic sequel of Uncle Tom, in which he just...
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, it was like children of Eliza's son, who goes to freedom, who achieves freedom, wants to marry a white woman and is refused by... You know, these are the political fantasies of Thomas Dixon, but he thought he was continuing the story in a way that reversed it, and he did.
Because he's no longer sympathetic.
By the time you get to...
He's now a rapist, or a potential rapist.
He's a rapist, yeah. So how did this happen? This is the story of American history and Reconstruction era sort of... not managing to reconstruct race in American culture, and so film becomes the new medium that is capable of making people feel strongly against black people, and so racism, it goes back and forth. We get sympathetic racial antipathy, and it's a very sad story.
Yeah, well, I mean, but that's not the end of it. So Birth of a Nation was in 1914, right, I believe?
1915.
15 came out, okay. And, but you finish, as you said, with Roots, which was, oh my gosh, possibly the most important, certainly television show or movie that I saw as a child. That came out in 1977? I think so, 76 or 77.
Boy, I have forgotten.
I'm 90% sure it's one of the two. But it was a multi-part series on television that I think it was the most viewed TV show ever. It was. At that point.
Restaurants did not serve food. Everyone stopped to watch
it. And I was in sixth grade in Berkeley, in Columbus Middle School. And all the kids were talking about it.
Yeah.
And some of the kids started chanting Roots once, and a lot of us white kids took it as a threat, as a matter of
really?
Fact. Oh, yeah. There was, you know, we were the first generation to be bused, you know, involuntarily. And so there was a massive social engineering project in the city, and I was the very first. I was bused in kindergarten, and that was the very first group of children in the entire country who were bused. You know, it had its benefits, but it also was a nightmare for a lot of us. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, there was a whole lot of conflict between blacks and white, black kids and white kids. A lot of it violent that never gets talked about. And unfortunately, the oppressed in those situations tended to be the white kids. So, but this is sort of a digression. You talk about Roots as flipping it again. Right. So Alex Haley writes the book Roots, which I read, by the way, under the covers with a flashlight, which is a giant novel.
Really fat novel.
Very important thing.
Like
for me.
Uncle Tom, like so Gone with the Wind, all of these big.
Totally engrossing. Yeah. And I began my fascination with black culture and black history at that time.
With Roots.
With Roots.
No kidding.
Roots and living in a mostly black neighborhood and the music of the time. But Roots was really important. So this was the book came out earlier. So this would have been the mid 70s for me. But you talk about Roots as using the Tom figure very differently. Right, Alex?
Yes, yeah. I'm interested in now the transition to television, a different mass medium, but a mass medium that did really change the way people thought. And Kunta Kinte as the hero, it's like a remedial fixing of the Tom story. So Kunta Kinte is a warrior. He is able to, he tries to escape being captured, and he, you know, he gets enslaved, but generationally over time, and this is the kind of seriality of the beginning seriality of melodrama, not that melodramas had not been serial before, but of the melodrama of black and white. The story gets told in a way that can redeem the Tom figure. But Kunta Kinte is heroic, although he's castrated, you know, by losing his foot. He can't run anymore. But over time, there's this kind of hopeful regeneration of black pride and power and the endurance of the family. And it was a book, you know, it was kind of a bogus book in a lot of ways because it was made up. Not the true story that he supposedly was telling, but nevertheless, it was for its time a way of post civil rights indicating the possibility of dignity and hope for the family, the black family.
And freedom.
Yeah.
Led by men who could have been Toms because they were the subject of, you know, tremendous. I mean, Kunta Kinte has his foot cut off. They're all whipped. The women are raped, but generation after generation of this family rises gradually and ends and culminates in birthing Alex Haley, who's a member of this family,
right.
At least allegedly, who becomes Malcolm X's, you know, biographer, and he is in the Coast Guard, and he writes the most famous and important book.
Importantly, the beginning of the serialized television show begins with Alex Haley telling the story.
A black man.
He is the success.
The descendant of would-be Toms, of men who could have been Toms, but chose not to
but
be.
But the descendant of Kunta Kinte,
who overcame his Tom status. He could have been a Tom.
And who played Kunta Kinte's uncle or noble uncle in the film, in the TV show? Who gave a glorious...
I don't know.
Run. You don't remember.
I can guess.
O.J. Simpson.
Oh, well, here we go. So, yeah. This is, and you write about the O.J. Simpson trial too, don't you?
As part of the melodrama of Black and White.
As the enduring melodrama.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Between Black and White in this country.
Yeah.
And that's how, God, you're so right about that. It is just, it's a nonstop melodrama, if you look, I think, mm-hmm. and it mm-hmm. continues. And mm-hmm. it's maybe more melodramatic today than it ever has been.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Don't you think?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, how do you, what do you make of sort of the recent upsurge of, you know, well, I mean, activism among Black students around race on campuses. I mean, do you see it as a part of this tradition of melodrama, being melodramatic? I do.
Well, I think it will be considered an insult if I
yes, it would. I'm asking you a really dangerous question, yeah. But you have tenure, so you're fine.
yeah, well, I do think that, but I think melodrama is also a force. It is a, mm-hmm. a powerful force in the culture, mm-hmm. and it's a bit of a bind, because if you can't portray yourself as a victim, then the only other option you have is to be full of rage and violent. Mm. And there is this moral authority that comes from having been victimized. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not really powerful amongst Black students on campuses. It's not the only thing that they can do. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I am worried about the culture of victimization that prevails, and I worry about it especially in the classroom when students say that they don't want to be exposed to things because they might hurt them or they might trigger reactions that in them. And if that is the case, then I'm afraid...
Then none of your books will be assigned
education
in classes.
Education is... education around any of the sensitive topics that we need to talk about becomes foreclosed. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really unfortunate.
I agree with you.
And that's why I think I'm glad I'm not teaching right now, because I would probably not be able to teach what I would want to teach.
I wonder about that. Yeah. I wonder if you... I don't think your books would go over too well these days, mm-hmm. right? That's a great ending, but I'm not done with you. I do have another question that's maybe a little bit off here. But
you can do it in the editing, right?
No. It's fine. This is an organic podcast. Okay. We just flow here.
Oh, okay.
No, I mean, but it does kind of tie it all together, so it's a good ending, I think, as well. Which is, you've written about pornography, and you've written about race, and you've written about race in pornography, and you have some arguments that you've made on that. I'm not super sure I'm in agreement with you here, but lay them out. Like what you've
I haven't really written about. I mean, I have like one article that talks about race in
You edited the volume that's about this, right? Or much of it is about this, about race and porn. There's a whole section at least, right? And you have an essay in it.
There is. Yeah.
And you have an whole essay in it, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay. Well, just talk about it. I mean, what do you see going on there?
Well, what I initially noticed was that pornographers like to portray themselves as liberal. And because they like to portray themselves as liberal, they like to say that they don't, what's the liberal position in America on race, that you don't pay attention to it.
Colorblind.
We are colorblind.
Right.
I have a friend who says that colorblind does not exist, but color mute definitely exists. Yeah. And so...
Meaning we don't talk about it.
That's
to me what liberals do. They see it all the time.
Right.
They're obsessed with it.
But they don't talk about it. Right.
They don't talk about their own feelings about it. Yeah.
And so I just discovered this, I think it was called... something about the color line, and it was this porn film in which it was pseudo, you know, in the new form of pseudo documentary, where porn performers would be interviewed, and they would say the approved liberal thing. I look at the person, I don't look at the color.
Right.
And then you see them acting in a scene in which it's all about put your black cock up my white ass or something like that.
And I love your black cock, and my God, your black cock is so big, unlike my husband's white cock, right?
Exactly.
It's nothing but pointing out the differences.
And so I was just fascinated by the contradictions, you know, which is natural.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you just got
I mean, to me, they're saying when they're acting what liberals are thinking but not saying.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
I mean, yes.
It's just the return of the repressed.
Yeah,
there.
It is. Okay. Yeah. But no, I did have a section of that anthology which I edited, which just opened up the discussion of sexualized and racialized desires,
mm-hmm.
It opened up a discussion that had not been taking place that I was pleased to see.
You made this serious thing to study. That's right.
Yeah. But I don't have any solutions to it.
Okay. Well, I don't want solutions to it. I don't think there's a problem with it. I mean, to me, pornography is amazing in a few ways. One of them is that it's just democratic is not the right word.
No, but it speaks the truth in ways that are often surprising.
Well, Anna Arrowsmith, who's been on my show, she's a feminist pornographer from the UK. You know, this is her thing. This is her argument. I just think it's brilliant. You know, she says, pick the thing that you hate the most about your body and then go to Pornhub and you'll find a category that celebrates that very thing.
And
you'll find thousands or millions of people who love that thing more than anything else, right? So that means there's a place for everyone in there, right? To even feel good about themselves. That's quite something. But I think on race, I mean, there's just far more interracial relations in porn than there are in the society at large we live in right now.
Yes.
Much of it, of course, you know,
is fetishization
plays on the old black stud stereotypes,
right?
You know, all that, sure, no doubt about it. But then again, I mean, you know, the black man having sex with a white woman is the oldest and gravest taboo that they just violate right and left, you know, and I think that alone is, I think, progressive, isn't it? I mean, I think just having that and celebrating it and putting it right in your face is, I mean, it's certainly...
In certain contexts, but in other contexts, it could be absolutely regressive.
Okay, how so?
Well, if you have an audience of white racists who just see their own validation of their stereotypes in the representation... Then if that would be the context that would be regressive.
But hang on now. I mean, so Deep Throat, as you said, was all about being concerned. The problem in Deep Throat was, you know, women's inability to climax, to have an orgasm, right? And in other words, the problem was women's desire.
Yes.
Right? And there was an attempt to at least find a way to please women. I mean, it was silly and absurd and all that.
Which happened to please men.
Certainly. No doubt about it. But
through this newly invented form of fellatio.
But you know, porn in the last 10 to 20 years, gonzo forms, like what John Stagliano has done, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's what he's been most interested in, is like women's desire, women's pleasure, women's orgasm. In interracial porn... It's the women desiring the black man. That's what's going on. That, to me, was, by the way, when I teach the history of the Ku Klux Klan in the 1920s, when it was 6 million members strong, that was the heyday of the Klan. If you read their literature, you read their discourse, it's very clear that that's what they were primarily afraid of.
Of course.
Women's desire for black men, for Italian men, for Jewish men, for dancing in jazz clubs, right, for intermixing sexually. And so in porn, where there's interracial sex, I mean, I think it's almost always the woman has a special desire for black men in this whole new cuckold genre in porn, right? Which that's exactly what it is. You even have the male, the white man husband sitting there watching while the wife is doing what she'd rather do, which is be with a black man.
Yeah.
So I can't think of anything in American history taken as a whole that would be more subversive.
I see.
Okay.
Is that all right? No, I accept that.
Oh, good.
I accept that.
Okay, good. That'll be your next book, maybe. Well, this has been a great pleasure.
Me too.
And I'm just so grateful for this. And I told you before this that academics are very skittish, generally, but you have not been at all. You've been very forthcoming and open and honest and a great unregistered guest. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
All right, cool. This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. To become a member of Renegade University, go to renegadeuniversity.com. And to get more info and to buy tickets for the upcoming Renegade University weekend in Oakland and San Francisco with me and Daniel Coffeen, go to renegadeuniversity.com/live. Thanks for listening.